All right, so we continue our study of the Ten Commandments. What I want to do today is, I want to bring us back up to speed, you know, from what we've already rehearsed, which is the first five, all right? And then, you know, we'll jump into the final five. I think we can get through them today. And I want us to start looking at the rabbinic thought process when it comes to being good, okay? These Ten Commandments. Are they asking us to be good? Is that what it is? Or is it something else? Obviously, you know, I've already let the cat out of the bag. You know, the Ten Commandments are basically evangelistic in nature, you know? Therefore, the other people on the outside of God's people, on the wrong side of the wall, to look over the wall and say, I wish I had a life that looked like that. You know, if you read Deuteronomy, it says it pretty plainly. What other God is so near to a nation? And what other God has such righteous commands so that the people flourish the way they do? And so, you know, they are completely designed to be evangelistic in nature. However, there's no question that, you know, they do put moral restraints on the culture, on the society. No question about that. And a few other things. But, you know, I want you to understand that there is not a thought process amongst God's people as this is being written. There's not a thought process that says, I need to be perfect. Okay? And, you know, they understood God's grace better than you think that they understand it. All right? And so, now, let me just walk through, you know, the commands here very, very quickly. I'm going to say some, you know, very sharp, stark things about the first five commandments that, you know, we have already talked about in detail. If, you know, for those of you out in radio land, if you know, this is kind of catching you by surprise, go back and to part one, part two, part three of the Exodus 20 study. But what I'm going to do is just bring us up to speed and then move into the next five commandments. So here we are. In Exodus 20, beginning in verse 1, and God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. If you don't believe that, the Ten Commandments don't mean anything to you. Okay? That's number one. You shall not have any other gods before me. Obviously, you know, God is unique. There are other gods. There's no question. We've just seen him defeat several other gods, soundly, in Egypt. There are other gods, but no God like him. He is the God Most High. He's the Creator God. There's no other God who creates. And so, you know, there's no other God who sustains. God is completely unique. So God is an Elohim, and all the other gods of Egypt are also Elohim, but, you know, none of the gods are the Elohim of Egypt or God Most High. And so he's unique in every way. He's one. And so you shall not make for yourself the carved image or any likeness, anything that is in heaven above or that is in earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them and serve them, for I am the Lord your God. I'm a jealous God, visiting iniquity of the fathers of the children on the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. So, we see that it's not about a series of do's and don'ts. It's all about worship. It's and when it comes right down to it, the Ten Commandments are completely focused and encapsulated in the family. I mean, if you look at the Ten Commandments and don't see the family, you're not looking at the Ten Commandments correctly. You should see the family. And we talked about the fact that God often, you know, addresses us as sons and daughters. Okay, so we should see ourselves coexisting with God inside of the family structure when you read the Ten Commandments, and that's what this is all about. It's all about worship. It's all about worship. And then we move on. You shall not make the name of the Lord, take your, the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless that takes his name in vain. You can't put on a Yahweh t-shirt and act other than Yahweh. Basically, that's, you know, it's not about cursing. You know, I mean, there's no question that if you can use God's name flippantly, obviously, you know, you're taking the Lord's name in vain. There's no question about that. But it goes much deeper than that. Again, you know, you don't curse your father. And guess what? That rolls right into, keeping the Sabbath day, keep it holy, 6 days you shall labor. I'm not going to read it all. You understand it. Set aside a day out of every seven that we're going to set uniquely in a family situation. Set aside, make a space that's so sacred that we honor the family and practice it in the deepest way possible. Okay? And then we're turning the corner here from focusing on God the Father, and now we're about to turn the corner and focus on how we're going to relate to each other. And the fifth command actually does that. Honor your father and mother that your days may be long in the land that the Lord has given you. Again, we talked about the fact that the verbs that are used here are the exact same verbs when it comes to relating to God. They're exactly the same. In other words, you should treat mom and dad exactly the way you treat God. Again, there was a lot of caveats. There was a lot of things we talked about there. Go back and listen to it if you're concerned about that. But the point is that it's all about family. And we would never humiliate family members, particularly mom and dad. Okay? It's all about family. And so, now, that being said, let's get into the commandments that you would think would be, you know, fairly simple. You know, you shall not murder, okay? Now, one of the things that you'll probably hear, especially when it comes to, you know, this command is, you know, this is the reason why, you know, we should be pacifists. You know, thou shalt not kill. There's a lot of people that take it as far as saying, you know, we should all be vegan because, you know, you have no right to go out and kill another animal that's out there in the world. But, you know, the Ten Commandments were written in context. They should be taken in context. And obviously, thou shalt not kill. You really have to go back to some of the older translations, particularly the King James, to find that word being used. Because, you know, there are very specific words that the Bible uses for, you know, what it is to take a life. And obviously, if you read it out of context and you take it that far, how in the world do you explain animal sacrifices that are commanded in the chapters right after this? You know, how do you do that? You can't, you know, so.
And how do you explain them taking over lands and killing people?
Exactly. Okay, yeah. Animal sacrifice, killing and war, both men, women, and children, killing and war, and capital punishment. How do you explain that? Okay, because when it comes right down to it, there is no sacrifice for sin. You can't just sacrifice your way out of sin. You can't do it. You know, if you murder, if in other words, ratzah, let me get into it a little bit more so that we can start talking about it logically here. Sarna is a scholar who created a commentary that's used a lot, especially when it comes to the Torah. he has some really good insight here. He says this, the Hebrew stem, ratzah, as noted, and he recognizes a couple of rabbinic authorities, applies only to illegal killing, and unlike other verbs for taking of life, is never used in the administration of justice or the killing of war. Okay? So, in other words, ratzah, whenever ratzah is used, it's always used for illegal killing. Okay, illegal killing. And illegal killing is set forth in Scripture by the intentional taking the life of the innocent. Okay, the intentional taking the life of the innocent. It also, you know, goes one step further, but there's restitution for manslaughter. Okay, because there's the cities of refuge that the manslayer can run to, so that the kinsman redeemer won't kill them, and they have to stay there until the high priest retires and changed out. Once that happens, then they're free to go. You're done, but you still have to have a trial of the elders of the city to say, yep. You know, you were negligent, you know, you let the axe fly off the handle and kill this guy, but, you know, just because you're stupid doesn't mean, you know, we're going to put you to death. But you will stay here in the city of refuge until, you know, the high priest changes, then you'll be free to go. Okay, so there's still punishment. You can't, you just can't take an innocent life and not be punished for it. So, he goes on, the Hebrew stem ratzah is never used in the administration of justice, killing, and war. Also, it is never employed with the subject of the action as God or an angel. Okay? God never ratzahs. Okay? When God kills, he kills the guilty only, not the innocent. Okay? Same thing with the angel of the Lord, obviously, God too. So God never murders. The angel of the Lord never murders. They never ratzah. This command, therefore, cannot be used to justify either passivism or the abolition of the death penalty, both of which have to be argued with, he says, from different grounds. If you're going to argue that, you can't go to the Ten Commandments and argue that there shouldn't be capital punishment. In fact, it's very difficult not to go back to Genesis and say, well, God created government just for that single sole purpose to begin with, you know, to exercise capital punishment. In other words, he's saying it's illegitimate to argue about these things based on the command. And it's easy to see, you know, it's abundantly easy to see in the Hebrew. He writes this, Genesis 9:6 provides the rationale for the prohibition of murder, okay, the taking of innocent life. Whoever sheds the blood of a man, this is what 9:6 says, Genesis 9:6, whoever sheds the blood of a man, by man shall his blood be shed, for in his image God did make man. And this means that society must exact satisfaction for the crime of murder because life, being derived from God, is infinitely precious and is his alone to give and to take. By his unspeakable act, the murderer usurps the divine prerogative and infringes upon God's sovereignty. And because human beings are created in the divine image, it's also affront to God's majesty. For this reason, it is not in the power of human beings to forgive a murderer or to commute the death penalty into ransom, as Numbers 35:31 makes extremely clear. You can't even acquit a murderer. You can't do it. And again, you know, oftentimes, and she was going to do, I think, a fantastic lesson on this, but, you know, oftentimes we think the sacrificial system was set up to somehow alleviate or relieve sin. It's not. There's no sacrifice for sin. There isn't any. If you murder, it's the death penalty. If you're an adulterer, it's the death penalty. Okay? If you lie in court It's the death penalty. Okay? There is no such thing as saying, I'm going to sacrifice this animal and walk away scot-free. There is no such thing. Sacrificial system was not set up for that at all. At all. And so, you know, you begin to understand in Numbers 35, 31, moreover, you shall accept no ransom for the life of a murderer who is guilty of death, but he shall be put to death. And so, you know, the interesting thing is, there's been a few scholars really try to dig into the data and research how well, you know, the death penalty was exercised in Jewish life, in Hebrew life. And, you know, the overwhelming evidence is they didn't hardly practice it at all. You know, it wasn't like they were killing somebody every day, which they would have probably almost had to do. But, you know, it was rare. It was rare. And so even in that day and time, if you were born on the right side of the tracks, you got away with it. If you were born on the wrong side of the tracks, you died, you know.
Kind of like now.
Exactly. Yeah, nothing's changed. The world never changes. It just never does. And so, you know, this whole idea of Ratzah is the fact that, you know, you are killing an innocent person, someone who is not facing the justice of God. Okay? You have laid in wait on purpose, and you've taken their life. Okay? Now, who has to practice these sorts of things? Well, it's everybody on the wrong side of the wall. It's everybody on the other side of the wall. Because on the other side of the wall, it's survival of the fittest. You know, we don't have, on the other side of the wall, we don't have a God who's so near to us. You know, we have gods whom we have to channel just their power and their thoughts through these statues so that we can even talk to them. They don't like to even come and see us. They don't like to visit us. They think we're noisy, that we smell bad. We're just annoying people. You know, they stay in their heavenly abode, you know, where there's quite a bit of abundance. And they don't care that all the rest of their subjects are scratching for a living. They don't care. And so when it comes right down to it, if you're living in that kingdom, then murder is almost required for survival. Anyone who gets in your way or anyone eating too much of your stuff, you have to kill them. Okay? And even yet today, I mean, it's great to be king because everyone who doesn't think like you, we just eliminate them. We just kill them. If you don't think like me, we'll kill you. You know, that's how, yeah, well, again, nothing changes. That's how we keep, you want world peace? Well, there you go. Let the blue side kill the red side or vice versa.
Yeah, that's it.
That's when you'll get peace.
Life of scarcity.
Yeah, it's the life of scarcity, exactly. Because, you know, looking over the wall, you see a life of abundance, you know. And so no one has to murder because no matter what you take, there's always more, you know. The reason why murder isn't necessary, but the reason why there's a prohibition on murder is because we would look like the people on the other side of the wall. That's how they survive. They survive by murder. Okay, so I'm going to go through these things a little quicker than, you know, than I really wanted to, because, you know, I really want to get to, you know, the rabbinic teaching at the end. So there's a lot of things. There's a whole lot of things that, you know, we could say more about this whole idea of Ratzah, but you get the idea that there's no such thing as Ratzah of an animal. No such thing. It's moot. Okay. There's no such thing as Ratzah when it comes to capital punishment. Okay. Completely different word. Completely different thought process. Okay. And so that's it. And rightfully so, the newer translations, understanding that quite well, you know, translate it, thou shalt not murder. You know, there's a big difference between, you know, slaughtering an animal and murdering an innocent person. Okay, you get that. Okay, so now let's move on to the next command, which, you know, this is an interesting one here. You shall not commit adultery. Okay. Now, does adultery in the Old Testament mean the same thing as we think about today? And the answer to that is absolutely not. It does not have the same connotation at all. Now, what is adultery in the Old Testament? Well, it's pretty straightforward. Here's an excerpt. Wyndham wrote the Word Biblical Commentary, and he probably, I think, you know, has the best just the best set of thoughts and ideas when it comes to adultery. He says, the ancient Near East attitude toward adultery has been surveyed, and he lists a whole bunch of people. They've commented respectively on texts from Egypt and Ugarit, which are, you know, same as the Old Testament, written about the same time. Adultery is referred to by the discreet euphemism, the great sin. You know, they actually call adultery the great sin. Okay, because and adultery and idolatry was looked at in the ancient Near East in the exact same way. Again, because remember, the Old Testament is all about family. Okay, and how do you disrupt a family quicker? Well, you bust it up by having an adulterous affair. You know, that's that the best way to bust up a family is something, you know, like that happening. The Hebrew verb for this great sin and the verb in the seventh commandment is nafah, to commit adultery. It is used in the Old Testament with both men and women as subject, though far more frequently of men, and by analogy as a designation of idol worship, the volition of the bond of the violation of the bond of covenant relationship with Yahweh, great sin, as used in the Old Testament of both of these betrayals. So there you have it. That is the prime thought of adultery. Now, what is it then? How does the Bible actually talk about it as far as, you know, one-to-one people are concerned? Obviously, the first thing you think about as far as adultery is concerned is sex, right? I mean, that's what you think about first. And it's interesting, Leviticus 18:20, you shall not lie sexually with your neighbor's wife, and so make yourself unclean with her. So the first thing that the Bible talks about as far as adultery is concerned is having sex with your neighbor's wife. In other words, And it even goes deeper. It goes deeper, you know. And we're not talking about orgies. We're not talking about you know, the 1970s free and open love and all that kind of stuff. What this is talking about is going and, you know, you're disrupting their family life and that sacred space and yours. Okay, so there's the whole idea of, This is done in secret. This is done against the family. Okay? It's done against the family. You know, in modern day, adultery is basically, you know, just something that someone goes to court with, you know. That's the basic premise, you know. You violated, you know, the marriage covenant, and now I'm going to divorce you and take everything that you have, and I'm going to do it, you know, by means of adultery. You know, I'm going to go to the judge with adultery. But, you know, the Bible never looks at things like that. It always looks at, you know, you're disrupting the family unit. Number two, a man having sex with a woman betrothed or engaged to another man, because, you know, the betrothal process and the marriage process was looked at as the same covenantal process. Deuteronomy 22:23-27, if there is a betrothed virgin and a man meets her in the city and lies with her, then you shall bring them both out to the gate, what, and let them sacrifice? And you shall stone them to death with stones. And the young woman, because she did not cry out for help, though she was in the city. And the man, because he violated his neighbor's wife. And then it goes on to say, if he does the same thing out in the country, he'll be killed, but she'll be set free because she probably cried out, but there is no one there to rescue her. Okay? But the point is, both the man and the woman, it takes two to tango, in other words, both the man and the woman get the death penalty. And the whole reason why is because we're cutting out the cancer that causes the family not to flourish. That's it. It's, you know, some of the interesting things. Let me just go on to point number three. This is the third point. A married woman willingly having sex with a man who is not her husband. And this is where, you know, Hosea, Ezekiel pick up the whole idea of idolatry. You know, when Hosea and Ezekiel is picking up idolatry, they're talking about a whore. Okay. And God, when you're out, thinking about other gods, the word that he uses for you is whore. Okay? That's his prime word, right? We all understand that. So we have three ways, three elements here, three trajectories that define adultery in the Torah. And it should be obvious, what isn't included. What's not included is a married man taking another woman or a series of women to be additional wives, so long as none of them were married or betrothed to someone else. That's not adultery in the Old Testament context. It's never defined as adultery, and it's never condemned. But it is that the norm? In other words, does the Bible say this is what we should be doing? Well, of course not. You know, the Bible, without question, the Bible presents a culture that God did not create, nor did he approve of. It presents a culture that God invaded. And God didn't necessarily change the culture. And the culture being a patriarchal culture, and then a monarchy. So we went from patriarch to monarchs. A part of that is the rich guys, the patriarchs, and the leaders, they took more than one wife. Why? Well, because they had lots of flocks, lots of herds, lots of, things to do, and they need lots of kids. Well, one woman can only pop out so many babies, And so, they had more than one wife. Why do you think that, Abraham didn't go crazy when Sarah suggested that he, have a baby with Hagar, Well, because it was culturally, it was the thing to do. There was, But God said, no, slow down. You can have a baby with Hagar. That's not a problem. But, I'm going to do supernatural work for the chosen one, Isaac, not Ishmael. The barren woman is going to bear a child. God doesn't necessarily endorse it. Okay. He doesn't condemn it. But he doesn't endorse it. Why? Well, how do I know that? Well, it's easy. It's real simple. Again, looking at the whole context of the whole Bible, what does Jesus do when he's asked about marriage? Does he go back to the patriarch? No. He goes clear back to creation. He has to, because that's the blueprint. God didn't create Adam and three Eves. He didn't do it. He just created one Adam and one Eve.
Remember that.
Well, yeah, and that's the standard. That's the blueprint for the family. The blueprint's back there. Just because it's not a sin, just because it's not adultery, doesn't mean God is approving something. The Bible speaks over and over and over again of many things that God never endorses. It simply records it.
And so, again, we're talking old law in adultery, in the home wrecking, okay, of a married man and a married woman and adulteress.
Right.
But the death thing, I don't understand, because now the children are hurt. Now the children don't have a father. Now these children don't have a mother. it's kind of counter, I mean, like, I can't wrap my head around it. I'm glad it's all done. We have the New Testament, which I love. But you see, so the wrecking continues when now you kill, stoned to death, two people who did the wrong thing. Now the children, you know.
That's in that time. And we think 20th century.
I mean, I shouldn't think too much. But
No. It's good to think. And I'm glad you did. And that's an excellent question, as a matter of fact. However, you know, the Bible always looks at it this way. You're better off dead or without the corruption. Okay? So that an orphan is better because, guess what? In that society, no one's going to be an orphan. Okay? They're going to be picked up by a kinsman redeemer. Okay? And so now we've eliminated corrupt dad, who's basically going to make one just like himself. And it's going to perpetuate. Or, you know, we eliminate the corrupt dad and a new dad steps up and now we've got the problem solved. And that's how the Bible looks at things.
That's why Jesus says, cut your hand off.
Cut your hand off, pluck out your eye if it's causing you to sin. It's way better, you know, to go into eternity with one eye than it is to burn in hell with both of those eyes causing you to sin. And you know, that's just the way, well, again, you know, I like to tell people that there's far more grace in the Old Testament than there is in the New Testament. But it can at least appear because, you know, we as 21st century Americans love to wink, wink, nudge, nudge, don't worry, 3 or 4 weeks will pass by and everybody forget about it and we'll just move on, you know. But the Bible doesn't look at things that way. Because no matter what, I mean, you know, rarely, you know, the Bible does say this, you know, a leopard does not change his spots. That's biblical. Okay. Can an Ethiopian change the color of his skin? Ethiopian's jet black. Can he change the color of his skin? Absolutely not. Can a leopard change his spots? Absolutely not. Do people change? Absolutely not. Until they're born again. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so, you know, yeah. So, there, you know, gosh, again, there's just so much we could talk about here. Levirate marriage is a part of it, where, you know, when your brother dies and now he's left a wife, it's your responsibility to bring her into your home as your wife and to perpetuate children with her because, you know, the Hebrews believed, for good reason, and if you think that the Old Testament doesn't speak loudly about afterlife, think again. Levirate marriage is one of the highest volumes turned up as far as, you know, them believing in the afterlife. But they believed, and probably rightfully so, that there's a very thin veil between Sheol and the living world. And what a tragedy it would be for you to have to watch your wife, well, too bad, lady, you know, off to the desert you go. Well, you'll die soon enough, you know, and that's exactly what would have happened back then. You know, she needed to be brought in to the house. And really it was all about the land anyway, because the brother's land is now occupied by his widow and hopefully children. But if no children, oh my, that's the worst thing that can happen, because now the land is probably going to be stolen out from the family, and that just can't happen. And so, you know, you bring her into your house as, you know, the survivor of the dead brother, and you make her your wife, and you also perpetuate the name of your dead brother so that the children will inherit the land, and it doesn't go anywhere. Mm-hmm. Very important. That was extremely important. Okay, because again, you know, we're family. Why? Well, family because God has put a wall around us and put us in the promised land. That land isn't supposed to go anywhere. That's the reason why that there's even a jubilee, because, you know, there has to be a forgiveness and all the land go back to the family members. Even if you go bankrupt and you have to sublet your land out, you know, after 50 years, it comes back into the family no matter what. And because the land was very, very important. And levirate marriage was all about that.
Was that just in the Jewish people, or was that practiced everywhere in the world?
It wasn't practiced everywhere in the world, but it wasn't practiced exclusively among the Hebrews. But primarily, yes, it was. Mm-hmm. So, you know, having more than one wife is not adultery, okay? It's not the blueprint, it's not the plan, but it's not adultery at all.
Even in today's time?
No, I mean, you can't say that it would be a sin. However, it's... Yeah, no, you are not walking according to the blueprint for sure. Right. So it should be discouraged. And obviously our laws do discourage it. Polygamy is against the law, which is a good thing.
So if you take a second wife in this culture, for many marriages you'd be breaking your marriage vows. So that's not adultery to break your marriage vows?
No, it's not adultery to make the same vow with more than one person.
Even if your vow was only one man and
forsaking
one,
all
mm-hmm.
others,
mm-hmm.
then you're breaking it.
That doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I agree. Because, you know, those vows are structured around the blueprint. Okay? Forsaking all others. However, those vows weren't the vows you took, because you knew for sure, if your brother dies, I've got to bring her into my home.
As an Israelite.
Absolutely. Levirate marriage was a very important part of society.
It helped people survive.
It helped people survive, and it maintained the land. It was very important that the land was maintained. Okay. Again, you know, there's much more to say about that, but, you know, we'll go ahead and move on. And again, you know, obviously, thou shalt not murder, death penalty. Thou shalt not commit adultery, death penalty. Thou shalt not steal. Not necessarily the death penalty, but was there a sacrifice for stealing? No, there was not. You had to pay back four times as much, restore and pay back four times as much. There is a penalty, you know, there's a penalty. There's no sacrifice for sin. Okay, so thou shalt not steal. Now, the interesting thing about this is, you know, it's interesting to talk to some of the Orthodox rabbis about this, because they'll tell you that this primarily, because the word here, the Hebrew word here, actually is the word for kidnapping, okay? They'll say that, well, you know, thou shalt not steal is exclusively talking about kidnapping, because, you know, you shall not covet is the same thing as you shall not steal, you know? So, you know, they'll fight that argument a bit, although, you know, for the most part, I think that, you know, that's an argument that doesn't stand up well, because, you know, the whole idea of thou shalt not steal, you know, definitely does encapsulate kidnapping, but it doesn't exclusively talk about kidnapping. It literally is talking about, taking people's property that's not yours. Sarna, again, is a good reference here. He says this: the precise application of this prohibition is complicated by the lack of specifics, because it really doesn't say anything specific. The Hebrew word ganav may cover theft of property and kidnapping. Rabbinic tradition interpreted the command according to the latter meaning. He went through all that, what I just said. It seems more reasonable to say it like this. This commandment is developed somewhat in chapters 21 and 22. So just because we're getting through the Ten Commandments doesn't mean we're finished with the law, because all the way through chapter 23 we're talking about the laws. Okay, and for the most part, you know, to make a long story short, a little less long. Clearly, the Israelites, he says, has some notion of ownership and rightful property for such a command to make sense. Stealing from one's neighbor, as with the seventh commandment, is a threat to society. It breeds distrust. It breeds strife. And guess what? It's what the people on the other side of the wall have to practice when they're scratching out a living. They have to steal from you. They have to, because they go to bed every night just a little bit hungry, worrying where their next meal's coming from. So they're going to take your stuff, because guess what? If you die, that's one less person I have to compete with. But on this side of the wall, in abundance, there's not even a motivation to steal, because you have everything that you need. And most things that you even desire and want on the other side of that wall. When you live in abundance, stealing, I don't think it even crosses the human psyche. Truly, if you think, again, if you think you have complete abundance, if you think your dead uncle has just left you $1 billion, instead of clicking on the Wells Fargo bank account, looking at your $25,000, wondering, is that going to be enough? Is that going to be enough? All of a sudden, you know, there's $1 billion of cash in your bank account now. It's real easy to say, I'm going to find someone and give away that $25,000 that I've been, you know, acting like Gollum over. Okay? And so, therefore, my precious, therefore, it stealing isn't a part of God's family. It's just not. It's not there. Okay? And that's the reason why you have to make restitution the way you have to make it. Because God is going to show you, not only did you not have to steal it, I'm going to make you give back 4 times more than you stole, and you're still going to eat tonight. Okay? And that is the way life works. In God's kingdom. It's the way life works. Oh no, this has happened. There's no way we're going to recover from this. Pish posh.
Feels like that.
But we do. We eat every single night because God's children are never seen roaming the streets begging for bread. That's the way it works. Okay, so now, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. Now, I'm going to go through this really quickly because, I mean, my goodness, the commentators, they write more on this than anything else. But here's the deal, okay? This has nothing to do with lying in just in general in life. This, if you are not in a court of law, you cannot break this commandment. If you are not before a judge, you cannot break this commandment. Okay? In other words, if Sheila comes to me and says, do I look fat in this dress? I can, without hesitation, say, you are the most gorgeous thing on the face of the earth. Whether it's true or not, you are the most gorgeous thing. I can lie and lie and lie, and it doesn't make any difference whatsoever. Because I am not breaking this commandment. I am not before a judge. I am not raising my hand saying, I am the witness to this tragedy, this corruption, and this is what needs... I'm not passing judgment on someone in a court of law. Okay? So, you know, I mean, the famous... Gosh, the famous story about this is Corrie Ten Boom and her sister... hiding Nazis, and her sister reading the Ten Commandments. Huh? Hiding Jews. Sorry. Yeah. Why would you hide? Now, why would you hide a Nazi? Yeah. Why would you hide a Nazi? But they're hiding Jews in the walls of their house, and they come in and say, are there any Jews in here? And Nodhead's sister says, oh, yeah, they're in the wall. I can't lie. Well, you know, no. You know, you practice lying and deceiving as best you can to thwart evil. You should be the best liar that you can be when it comes to thwarting evil.
Yes.
When it comes to
thwarting evil. So in other words, if you know that the road B leads over a cliff and road A leads to a Jewish colony, and a bunch of Nazis come by in their tank, you say, go down road B, and you watch them go over the cliff, hee hee ha ha. There's nothing wrong with that.
Rahab did it.
Sure, absolutely. There's There's lots of evidence in Scripture that's the way it is. You should be a good liar for the cause, okay? But you do not go to court and say, I saw this person do something when they didn't do it. First of all, that's the reason why there needed to be two witnesses, okay? That's the number one reason why there needed to be two witnesses is because of this command. But not only that, that's the reason why the penalty for this is taking on the penalty of the accused. Okay? So if they found that you were lying, you automatically suffered the penalty that you were trying to convict them of and see them experience.
Justice.
That's justice. Exactly. All right. So enough said about that. I mean, lying is a good thing, especially when it comes to thwarting evil. You'll never hear that in church, I can tell you that. This is serious business going on here.
Whoop, whoop!
Okay. Now, you know, again, I'm going to make short work of coveting here. There's a lot to it. I'm going to make short work of it. But we're going, as we go into a lot of the other laws in the next three chapters, you know, we'll keep coming back to this, and I'll keep expounding on it. But you shall not covet your neighbor's house, your neighbor's wife, his male servant, female servant, ox or donkey, or anything that is your neighbor's. You know, the thing is here, again, this all has to do with abundance and scarcity. It all has to do with accepting the lot in life that God has given you. Now, every single one of us has experienced the fact that, okay, you know, you're in your house and you go visit someone else's house that's nicer, and then you come back to your house and it looks like a greasy old lawnmower. Oh, doggone it. Before I went over there, I was perfectly happy with this house, but now this house looks like a greasy old lawnmower to me, you know? This house, the doors aren't 9 foot tall. And boy, I love those doors that are just 9 feet tall, you know? But, and you know, again, we're going to get into Romans chapter 7. We're not going to be able to do it today. Romans chapter 7, you know, talking about the fact that, you know, Paul is describing this whole idea, not only of coveting, but just the law in general. But again, you know, you have to understand it's written in context too. Paul is not talking to you, Gentile. You cannot take Romans chapter 7 and claim it for yourself. Paul is only talking to his Jewish brothers. That's not for you. It is not for you. But you know, you understand here that you know this whole idea of coveting. There's no such thing in life as someone who doesn't covet. No such thing. Everyone does. You know, there's times in life where, you know, You're introduced to your friend's husband, and you take a look at that guy, and he looks like a movie star, and man, he is just sweet as candy, and he looks me directly in the eye, and he swoons at what I say. Man, I married the wrong guy, you know? I mean, coveting happens all the time. All the time. Now, how do I want to end this? How do I want to, you know, work all this together? Here's the thing I want to say. And by the way, there are exceptions in God's Word, all the way through God's Word, for every single one of these commandments. These are never absolute. And again, you, ignorant, fact-checking American, can't understand this. But it's not. It's all about the heart. It's all about the family. For instance, guess who was not only a murderer but an adulterer simultaneously? Who was that?
David.
Oh, that was David. Oh, okay. So you know the whole story. I don't have to recount it for you. If you don't know the whole story, go to 2 Samuel chapter 11 and 12 and read the story there. But here's the end of the story. Here's the end of the story. David is completely convicted of both adultery and murder simultaneously, both of which hold the death penalty. David said to Nathan, "I have sinned against the Lord." And Nathan said to David, "The Lord also has put away your sin. You shall not die." Exception. Exception.
Keep your guns, everybody.
That's right. Completely. Yep, that's right. Because he had more to do with David, and David's sin was not going to get into the way of that path. Plain and simple. Now, why do I make that point? Well, okay, so here's the rabbinic teaching. Okay, here it is. And the rabbinic teaching, you've heard the story, or you've heard the axiom, actually, the bigger they are, the harder they fall, right? Well, that is what this is all about. And so the rabbis will come to you and they'll say, look, anytime in Scripture, the same exact sentence, the same exact thought is said about two different individuals, they're meant to be linked together, and most oftentimes they're meant to be contrasted against the other. Okay? There's this sentence. There's only twice in Scripture where an angel comes and makes a birth announcement. Now remember, we're talking rabbinic rabbi here. He's not looking at Old Testament or New Testament. He's only looking at Old. And there's only two times, Ishmael's birth and Samson's birth. So Ishmael and Samson are intrinsically linked, okay? And they contrast each other, all right? And so, Genesis 16:11, behold, you have conceived and you'll bear a son. And Judges 13:5, again, you know, the angel's coming to the parents of the wife of Samson's husband, behold, you shall conceive and will bear a son. And she said, they say this, since the tense of the English translation varies, many people have no access to Hebrew or rabbinic teaching, think that, you know, they're not identical phrases, but actually they are. Again, English translators take liberties all the time, you know, I mean, the words are completely identical, but yet they give the verb a different tense, which they shouldn't do. But no matter what, you know, he says, look at this. You know, Ishmael's mother, Hagar, finds his son a wife. Okay, Genesis 21:21, and his mother took him a wife from Egypt. Samson finds his own wife despite his parents' disapproval. So here becomes the contrast. They're saying these guys are linked together, but I want you to see the contrast. In Judges 14:2, get for me this wife. I mean, Samson goes back and says, hey, yeah, this is not, you know, our people, but she's a hottie. I want her. You go get this woman for me. I mean, so there's a stark difference between the lives of these two men. Now, to make a long teaching shorter, Ishmael didn't do anything crazy in his whole life. He didn't do anything in particular that was an egregious sin against God. Nor did he do anything great as far as the people of God or basically even his own people, nothing. He was basically just a steady kind of guy. Mm-hmm. You know, the kind of guy you want to marry, right? The kind of guy you want to take home to mom. That's Ishmael. Nothing great, but nothing terribly horrible either. But Samson's life is clearly divided into two sections, he says. from his birth in Judges 13 until the end of Judges 15, we see the Lord is with him constantly. The second part of Samson's life begins with him consorting with a harlot, Judges 16:1, and concludes with his death in Judges 16:30. During this time, the Lord appears to have abandoned him. Contrast the two phrases which conclude the two parts of Samson's life. And he judged Israel in the days of the Philistines 20 years. That's Judges 15:20. And in the second part of his life, he judged Israel's 20 years. Doesn't talk about the Philistines. Ancient Jewish wisdom teaches that during the first half of his life, his purpose and mission was defeating the Philistines and protecting Israel from them. During the second part of his life, he largely forgot his mission. So, in other words, and you know, he you know, him and Delilah, all the whole ball of wax. But the point is, you know, Samson defeated the Philistines. That's like saying the President of the United States went over and took care of Al-Qaeda. You know, I mean, the point here is he did great things. But in that greatness, he also fell greatly, okay? But the Jewish wisdom here is that God approved of Samson far more than Ishmael, okay? Far more. Far more than Ishmael, yes.
He doesn't like lukewarm.
No. Okay, now, I like the look on Jesse's face. But, okay, so here's the deal. Okay, here's the deal. If you're going to achieve great things, the Ten Commandments says that you're going to take your strengths and your weaknesses into that task. And as your strengths are magnified, so will be your weaknesses.
Oh, that's so true. So true.
It's very scary. But there's no reason to say, ah, the tallest trees catch the wind, so I'm not going to climb that high. Mm-hmm. That's the point. God is happier with you in your extreme devotion and your extreme failure as to your mediocrity. All right? So now you say, poo-poo on you, Mike. I don't believe a word of it. Well, okay, let's go to one more rabbi to see maybe if another rabbi agrees. Okay? And this rabbi's name is Jesus.
Oh. I was going to say, what do I care about a rabbi?
That's exactly what I saw in your eyes. And so, now, does Jesus think and act the same way? Yes. Why? Well, guess what? There are only two people in the New Testament that their births were announced by angels, John and Jesus. Mm-hmm. Aha. Now you're going to say, no, wait a minute, Mike. You're not going to tell me for one second that Jesus had weaknesses. No, I'm not, because he was absolutely God and without sin. However, the rabbinic thought is still here. Listen to what Jesus says to the people who are grumbling and complaining against him. For John came neither eating nor drinking, and they say he has a demon. So he was this mediocre guy. Nothing great, nothing terribly tragic about his life. No question, he led the people back, but he did it in a way that, you know, God even restricted. You know, you can't drink. You know, you're going to be in the hill country. You're not even going to be a part of society until this little slice of time. No one's even going to know you until, you know, you become the forerunner. But yet, Jesus is saying, but yet you're looking at him, and because you don't like what he said or what he did, he has a demon. And then he talks about himself. The Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they say, look at him, a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. Okay? Jesus is the Savior of the world, and they're accusing him of great faults. But here's the clincher. This is the rabbinic teaching. Yet wisdom is justified by its deeds. In other words, what have you accomplished? That's how we measure you. That's how we measure you. Yes, Jesus drinks. And yes, Jesus consorts with sinners. But look at what he's done. That's the litmus test. What have you done? What have you done? Have you just sat around in mediocre fashion? basically keeping your nose clean and nice and quiet and out of the limelight? Or have you gone into the battle with all your strengths and all your weaknesses and let the chips fall where they may? And so, to live by the Ten Commandments is to live a life that says, I am going to go out there with all my weaknesses because I want to break every single one of these commandments, but I'm going to strive with all my might to keep them. But I'm not going to not go because I've got weaknesses. And that's the Ten Commandments. It's all about family. And we live inside of them, and we're not condemned by them, as Paul says in Romans chapter 7.
Yes, like you're not going to go live like a hermit.
No.
So that you never get tested.
Correct.
Because what will you have accomplished?
What will you have accomplished?
For the family.
And if you're tested, they will see your weaknesses, and your weaknesses will present consequences to your life.
As Paul said in 2 Corinthians 12,
yep.
Therefore I will boast all the more gladly about my weakness.
Yep. Exactly. So, okay, so that's where we're stopping the teaching. Feel free to ask questions, and we'll see you next week.